In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And we have no Jeffrey.
No. We do have Jeffrey in absentia, though. He sent us in a voicemail.
That tickled me to no end. He called our own voicemail.
Yes, indeed. Mike, do you have that queued up?
Here we go.
Babcom link established.
Hi there, Tim and Summer. It's Jeffrey, and calling you from a 100-degree day in Burbank, California today. And I'm so sorry that my schedule has precluded me from being part of the show, but there was an important message that I wanted to convey, and if you'll indulge me, I wanted to ask that we dedicate tonight's show to a dear B5 fan, gentleman from Norway, Idar Nielsen. Idar became a friend of mine through B5 days over a decade ago, was a huge B5 fan, was a huge fan of the Babylon podcast, became personal friends with Pat and I, and Idar lost a battle to cancer this past weekend. Way too young to be taken from this earth, and he was such a positive and fun spirit and just always up and happy, and his wife Nadine and he were positive, up, bubbly people. You could not get this guy down. He was a crack-up and fearless, funny, willing to do anything at any time. Oh, my God. A great friend, a great loss, and E5 fans everywhere that knew Idar around the globe. We'll miss him and always remember him. Thanks for this. Have a great show. I'll talk to you guys next week.
Okay.
Oh, it is sad to lose one.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I recall that Pietar ever sent in any email or voicemail, but, you know, Jeffrey obviously was familiar with our show. So, yeah, that's a sad thing.
We wish Vidar's family well, send them our condolences.
Any other news, Summer?
Other than my never-ending, tireless internet trekking to try to find Ed Wasser, no. Although I am trying again to get a hold of Christopher Franke and Don Vickery, who I just discovered today. You also would love to talk to as well.
Yes.
He'd be fun to talk to. Mike Vejar, the director. I think we should get him on here. Because he's done a number of episodes that we have admired.
Yeah, and also he was a director on various Star Trek series, so I'd love to hear his views on the difference between those two shows actually working on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't have anything else other than that message from Jeffrey. He sent it on to the voicemail line. And what do you say we take a quick break and come back and do some deep geeking?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
On the next Babylon 5.
Delenn, fighting has broken out in the capital.
Civil war.
It started.
To save the Minbari from self-destruction.
The fire cannot be stopped.
A sacrifice must be made.
This ship cannot be allowed to reach home.
And Delenn's fate.
Bring her to me.
Will be sealed.
Victory will be ours.
On the next Babylon 5.
You've entered the twisted mind of Scott Sigler. You've descended into the inner darkness of Phil Rossi. Now, journey into the imagination of T. Morris. This is Moravi Remastered. The world's first podcast novel, reimagined with a new soundtrack, restored scenes, and the voice talents of Philippa Ballantyne, Christiana Ellis, and George Harab. And the podcast continues in the fall of 2008 with Legacy of Moravi. And in 2009 with an original podcast anthology, The Dragon Clan of Moravi. A project so sweeping in scope, an adventure so epic in scale, it takes two ballsy voiceover professionals to cut the promo. Moravi Remastered. Pirates, ninjas, and one hell of a good time. Subscribe at www.moravi.net and enjoy the ride.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is BE.
We are back to geek deeply on rumors, bargains, and lies.
Yes.
So what's more fun, the bargains, the rumors, or the lying?
Well, you know what? I think in terms of the characters of the show, I think Londo got the most pleasure out of lying.
No, really?
Yeah, I think so. That scene he has with the Drazi ambassador, I mean, he's already expressed his incredulousness that Sheridan wants him to deny allowing the White Star Fleet to patrol Centauri space. You know, he doesn't quite get it, but he'll go along. But I think that it gave him the opportunity to deeply insult the Drazi ambassador, certainly made up for any sort of consternation he had about maybe telling an untruth.
I honestly think Sheridan had more fun omitting the truth from the ambassadors. And Franklin's little, hey, we're going to need a lot of your blood. Can you send us? Okay.
Yeah. I'll be seeing you all later, probably.
Yeah. A lot of fun with the lying.
Yeah, it's a curious episode. I have to admit, the first few times I saw it, I wasn't that taken with it. And I'm not quite sure what it is, maybe because it's, you know, the stories are so, you know, the A story and the B story are so different from each other. I'm not sure what it is. I really enjoyed it this time around. I think at the beginning, at the breakfast scene, I thought that seemed a little forced with Sheridan over in the corner, you know, giggling to himself. That didn't quite work for me.
Yeah, the entire scene where he's sitting there muttering to himself, brooding, and then he starts explaining something that nobody else has any idea what's going on. The way he pounded the table and scared everybody.
Yeah.
That was funny.
That was funny. That looked like that was not expected by anybody.
No. The Zach grabbing the orange juice so it wouldn't spill all over the table.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Jeff Conaway's amusement and all that was genuine and not, you know, in necessarily part of him acting, if you catch the difference.
And I have to imagine that Claudia's little scream there was not intended.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought Ivanova's consternation through the whole thing was really wonderful. I thought that, you know, Claudia Christian's nonverbals throughout this episode were really, really nice. Yeah, that scene, especially when she's doing Voice of Resistance after Sheridan tells her, you know, tell him everyone that nothing happened in Sector 82 by 9 by 12. And he drops this on her just before she goes on the air. So, you know, there's these expressions running across her face, you know, as they're counting down to on screen time. It was just really I don't know. There's something that's extremely amusing about that. I really like that.
And it actually plays into everything else about that part of the storyline. Everything is about him keeping people off balance.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
They can't have any time to react the way they would if they had time to think. They're reacting and making choices that he wants them to make.
Yeah, this is definitely Sheridan the manipulator in action here, and I think that's something that is very different for that character. I wouldn't say it's out of character, but it's just different. You know, in the past, his whole approach is not lay everything out on the table, but, you know, a more straightforward, here's what we want, here's what we want to have happen. Let's work together to make it happen. And now that he's realized it's not going to happen, you know, as he tells the command staff at the beginning of the episode, let's not give them what they want. And of course, by doing that, he achieves his end.
Bye.
You know, and I loved how he works up the Drazi ambassador and then the rest of the League of Non-Aligned Worlds. I mean, they're practically frothing by the time they get into the council chambers.
Yes. Absolutely. Nothing happened today in Sector 83x9x12.
Yeah, for those of you who asked. What is you can see repeats of repeat, nothing happened. Try to stay calm.
Everyone, stay calm.
What?
It would have been so much better if she had just finished that with nothing to see here. Move along.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see, what else?
From the very opening, everything was about presenting something else, something other than what you were led to believe the entire time. Even with Narun being on the Lens ship, everybody else thought there was a different plan in place,
mm-hmm.
except, you know, she, because, you know, she and Narun had a plan together.
And Lanier trusts Delenn enough to know that even if things are not as they seem, that she has a plan. And, you know, that was kind of the point from that part of the story. You know, the religious caste, they have their own assumptions about what the warrior caste are up to, and they, rather than trust Delenn, who they, you know, apparently trusted all this time, you know, they jump to their own conclusions with potentially disastrous results, acting on those rumors again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And there's one thing I noticed. Lanier has an uncanny ability to be lurking around the corner just when he needs to be lurking around a corner.
Who said he was lurking?
Well, I guess it's true. I mean, what do you think? Do you think Delenn had him, or... No, I don't think Delenn had him keeping an eye on the religious caste, but do you think he's just become that cynical at this point in the story that...
I think he might have had an inkling that other religious caste members were not as open-minded as Delenn and might do something foolish. I believe it's entirely possible that he was spying on them in order to learn if there was something he needed to protect Delenn from.
Okay, I could accept that. I mean, it's apparent that he understands the different worldviews that are in play, even with his own caste. So... I could say, I think it's possible he takes it upon himself to do that, sure. I'm also thinking, you know, he's lying in bed, I guess, in the Minbari equivalent of Med Lab, and just happens to see Narun stroll on by.
Yeah, I thought that was a little convenient.
See, and that's one of those things, I can't decide whether that was intentional on Narun's part, Because we find out, of course, later in moments of transition that apparently he and Delenn were in cahoots. Even, I mean, I'll say this, at the end of the episode, first time I saw it, it was like, to me, it was like a punch to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
When he goes off and he basically calls Shakiri and says, okay, well, I got their plans. I know what they're going to do. We can stop them pretty easily. You know, it won't be a problem. You know, because that's, at that point in time, like you've almost got to the point, much like Delenn, you know, grudging admiration for Narune. And then he does this and you're expecting, you know, that's a sucker punch. But as it turns out, apparently this was all kind of part of the plan that the two of them had put in place. So, I mean, do you think then maybe that Narune strolled by MedLab with the intention of arousing linear suspicion?
No. I mean, why would he need to have Lanier, who's been injured, report back to Delenn something she already knew was going to happen?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm trying to make sense of it. I mean, otherwise, it's frankly weak storytelling. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's kind of a dumb point because we don't know what the layout of the ship is, and maybe if you had to get to the docking bay, you got to stroll by sick bay.
If you look at the overall pattern of the episode, everything's about misdirection.
Uh-huh.
That was a misdirection intended for the benefit of the audience. Because you have Sheridan doing misdirections in order to get the ambassadors to do what he wants them to do.
Uh-huh.
You have Delenn and Narune setting up a misdirection that we think they're trying to negotiate a peace. But it's something different than we could even have imagined, as we find out later.
Right.
And so why not include the audience in on that misdirection? I mean, we are part and parcel of the misdirection. I mean, we are fully engaged. We know what Sheridan is doing ahead of time. With the Minbari situation, we don't know everything that's going on. And so that last final thing was to send us off in one direction. We're supposed to think she failed.
Right. Right. And like I said, the first time around, I definitely got that feeling. I guess all I'm talking about is just kind of the convenience of having the character walk by another character who then kind of follows him around. You know, I'm not... I guess that's part of the misdirection. It just doesn't seem quite as tight. Or I'm not sure I can quite put my finger on it. It just seemed just kind of convenient to have one character walk by another at the same at that moment. You know, I don't know.
Right.
I'm like, but again, that's kind of, you know, I guess that's kind of picking nits to a certain extent, because otherwise, I think the episode is stronger than my recollection of it from the last time I'd seen it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a completely, completely good nit to pick. Because everything else in the episode was so wonderfully paced in terms of humor, in terms of suspense. And we were actually set up with the humor in the opening part, you know, with everyone's reaction to Sheridan reacting strangely.
Yeah.
And nobody's really quite sure where he's coming from, what he's doing. And even the part where Ivanova walks over and sniffs his juice cup after he's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, that's priceless. I mean, just checking. And then we switch instantly to somber, where Delenn is viewing footage of, you know, the capital city burning, or burned.
Yeah, while she's watching footage of it, basically, you know, before the Civil War. But yes, you're right. It's an interesting contrast that way. And you know, the scenes with the individual characters, I really liked a lot of the flow in that. One of the conversations I liked was between Sheridan and Londo when they got to talking, you know, when Sheridan comes to him and says, look, I want you to, if anybody asks, deny it. And Londo is completely stumped and he's fooled. He's like going, you know, I don't get you, you're humans. I've been studying for a while, and it gets this wonderful tangent about Rebo and Zooty. And it's, I mean, the sparring between the two characters is nice. Londo's like, I don't get what's so funny about it. And Sharon is like, what? It's funny. I didn't get it. Well, that's not my problem. I mean, it's just like this whole, it's like the whole conversation kind of got off the rails in this other thing that made me laugh. I like that a lot. You know, Londo's like, that's not the point. You don't know. No. The point is.
Yeah. I mean, even for nonsense. The tangent with Londo still trying to understand humans is actually funny, because he's saying, okay, wait, you want me to do what? Now, hang on a second. Explain that. Why should I do this when you really need this? But you're not going to, what? The whole, with him trying to figure it out and then giving up, because he's distracted by, oh, you think they're funny. I'm sorry.
I said, I love Sheridan's response. I didn't get it. That's not my problem. and then the next scene with Londo and the Drazi ambassador is great. It's, you guys have those little beady eyes. It's amazing you don't fly in the planets.
The great maker gifted us with great big eyes. Never mind.
Right. Oh, that was so funny. I gotta say this, you know, the makeup from Optic Nerve Studio for the Drazis, it was so expressive, you know? I mean, you could really, again, another scene with the Drazi ambassador and Sheridan and the Zocalo, where they get to the sort of the verbal or the logical loop. Well, you're not denying it. Well, I'm not denying it, but I'm not confirming it either. I mean, there's so much in the universe that I could deny. We'd be here forever. I don't think I understand. but the expressions on the face really brought the ambassador to life, the Drazi ambassador. You know, he never, you know, knowing that it is makeup and prosthetic, it was amazingly expressive.
And I think that's what made, you know, Babylon 5 so much more enjoyable. You could actually step back for a moment and forget that those people were wearing masks.
Yeah.
Because the masks allowed them facial expressions. And, well, it didn't hurt that the writing, for the most part, was pretty damn good. And that the aliens were shown to have as much feeling and foibles as all the humans.
Yeah.
But they did certain things differently.
Yeah.
And may I add that I saw a Markab mask on sale on eBay and was going, ooh, pretty.
And how much of your hard-earned credits did they want for that thing?
A couple $100. I was like, ooh, I'll just look at it here.
Huh.
Yeah. Little
dead race, though, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's see what else we got. You know, there's that final scene in the League of Non-Aligned Worlds in the council chamber, where they basically called Sheridan in and quote unquote lay down the law for him. Of course, it's exactly everything he wanted.
I love their reasoning. No, don't tell him what we know. Let him wonder, otherwise he'll know where we got the information and shut those lines off to us.
Yeah.
In the problem.
Yeah. Well, what if we need the White Stars for bigger missions? Well, we'll come along with them then.
And you can see he's like trying not to giggle.
Yes, right. Well, if that's the way you want it, gentlemen. And then again, you... You may leave now, Captain. I mean, they're so condescending. It was so funny.
Let them think they have the upper hand and they've won. And they're doing exactly what he wants.
Yep. Yeah, White Star ships, they don't just blow up asteroids for no reason.
Yeah, the whole thing with them being invisible.
Yeah.
Like, invisible enemy. They have Vorlon technology. Maybe they can see them and we can't. They're not sharing with us. What are we going to do? Maybe they're all around us right now.
I was just waiting for one of them to run into a support post or something. That would have just been the capstone to it.
Oh. A tiny, tiny bit of Keystone Coppery mist. Now that would have been funny. If we had seen them just scatter down the hallway and see two of them come running back and run into each other.
Yeah. And speaking of other groups, I did like the confrontation between the religious caste and the warrior caste at the beginning when Narune comes aboard the White Star. And there's the two groups just kind of staring at each other across the hallway.
Yes. The animosity you could literally walk on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like, you know, and one of the things I thought was very poignant at the beginning when Delenn was looking at images of the capital city and talking about it with Lanier, and, you know, she says, I see my beautiful city in flames, and I wonder if it's all my fault. Which is an interesting contrast, because at this point, you know, she's kind of begrudgingly, maybe not begrudgingly, but she's beginning to wonder whether or not the choices she's made and the actions she's taken haven't had negative consequences. And on the flip side, Narune is grudgingly coming around to thinking that, well, you know what? She might have been right after all.
She might be second-guessing herself, because she knows she made a mistake in giving the go-ahead to seek out retribution for what the humans did to Dagat.
Uh-huh.
And now she's wondering if maybe her good intentions to fight the shadows have backfired by destroying the council. She didn't think that the three castes were, or mainly the warrior caste and the religious caste, were so out of sync with each other that without the influence of the Great Council, things would spiral this far out of control.
Well, you know,
it's like,
and
like Lanier said, you know, she lives in a better world. You know, she doesn't see these things. Maybe she really did have blinders on.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, even with Narune's apparent betrayal of her, which we know, of course, subsequently really wasn't, you know, he says to her toward the end of the episode that, you know, I begin to think that, you know, I just thought you were a religious fanatic. Now I see that you had higher ideals. Mm-hmm. And in so many words, says, I forgot the fact that you were chosen of Dukat, which carries, you know, a certain
weight. A lot of weight.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, he kind of comes around to see the fact that, you know, she had a higher vision, shall we say. Yeah.
He's slowly coming around to realize, you know, Dukat would not have picked a fanatic to follow him.
Yeah. And I really, you know, this is one of those episodes with Lanier. He has really come to a different place in his outlook on life. You know, he's so far removed from that timid acolyte from Temple, you know, to the fact that he is making decisions and doing things, balancing out Delenn's idealism versus the ugly reality of the world around him. As he tells the one Minbari, you know, he's, you know, said, well, why did you lie for us? And he says, because she thinks we're better than we are. And I won't have anything destroy that. And the guy says, well, thank you for that. And he goes, but I didn't do it for you. and you know, it's sad to see that kind of a I don't want to say cynicism, but, you know, Lanier realizes what's at stake, and, you know, he'll protect the woman he loves, the Lynn, from anything. You know, even so far as to cover the truth.
And like I said, that's why I think that he did the snooping on his own. Something he heard or something he sensed about their behavior was right. off, and he decided to go find out.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that scene in the darkened chamber where she's talking with the other members of the religious caste, and you know, after Nerun's been attacked, she's, you know, unknowingly says, "See, you know, we always knew they were erratic. If they would harm another man, one of their own cast members, thinking that they were going to surrender." And all of a sudden the conspirators are like, wait a minute.
And she's like, no. She explains it to them. They go, oh, crap, you couldn't have told us this a couple hours ago.
Well, but see, the thing is, she didn't think she would need to.
This is true.
And that's it. That's Lanier's point right there.
And the other thing is, the more people who knew, probably the more people their plan would not have succeeded.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And as we'll find in the next episode, Nerun's actions are just as much to maintain the confidence of his own caste to maneuver mm-hmm. them in a place where, you know, they can act their plan to basically try to reunite the Minbari people, but that's for the next mm-hmm. round of speaking.
Yeah, he gets to play out his part of the line.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's interesting because in a sense he is knowingly playing out the lie. Delenn isn't. She's making the bargain.
Mm-hmm.
But Nerun's got to be the one who's got to out and out lie.
Hmm.
You know, because she's making
the offer because she knows what's at stake. Her side is bargaining with Nerun to get him to see what's really going on, and the only way, or the best way for everybody, for it to end. So she presents him with a bargain, and he has to lie to carry it out. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, because you know, in the end, even though he comes to Shakiri with supposedly the plans of the religious caste offensive, we never actually see him deliver that. He never says, here's what they're planning to do. He gets in to see Shakiri and says, okay, now wait a minute. You know, you really want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Think about this. So, and you know, and I think it was, again, to play off the thing, I think Nerun was definitely being honest with Delenn when they were talking earlier on, and he says, you know, I'm as horrified by this as you are. You know, I think he really understands what is at stake here, that this is bigger than just, you know, dominance.
It's about the survival of everybody, of all Minbari.
So, yeah, it's interesting. I you know, Nerun really, he's one of those characters, he really, like Bester, he's not there a lot, but I think he casts a long shadow. And, you know, his grudging acceptance of Delenn in this episode is a nice touch. And I love the bit, you know, where she says, you know, we've argued, we've disagreed, we've stood on opposite ends of things, but I'd rather have someone who stands, you know, against me from the honesty of their principles rather than because they think it's the right, you know, agreeing with me because they think it's what should be done. Mm-hmm. You know, that little bit, he says, is that a compliment? She says, well, after a fashion.
Yeah.
You know, and turns it around at the end where he tells her things about her, you know, and she goes, well, is that a compliment? Yeah, after a fact. Nice little touch.
Nice little counterpoint there, yeah.
Yeah. So let's see, what else? Well, you know what? I don't know, have we talked about everything in the episode? Specifically, because I have a couple little minor points to touch on. But.
Yes, the whole little propaganda thing with the Ivanova.
Yeah.
Franklin asking for blood.
Yeah. I like the little bit in the Minbari Jeffries tube with Lanier.
Did you say Jeffries tube?
What's that?
Did you say Jeffries tube?
I didn't say Jeffries tube. What was a Jeffries tube?
Your Star Trek is showing, sir. Star Trek, sorry.
It was a Jeffries tube.
It was a ladder with a plastic bag around it.
Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing. This is what was kind of neat about it, the way they showed it. It was, you know, the shots of Lanier climbing up into the thing was obviously he was climbing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But when he comes out of it onto the deck,
sliding,
you get a sense that there's a gravity plane shift because it's obviously shown running parallel to the floor. And I thought that was a neat little touch.
Interesting.
The other thing about this episode, and this is purely a personal point, we've heard plenty of people who said that they've had to track down B5 when it was shown at like 2 a.m. in the morning or whatever, right? Second time I ever saw this episode, I was in Orlando. Actually, it was a family thing, okay? And I must have ate a bad hot dog at Kennedy Space Center or something because I was sick as a dog for the rest of the day and into the night, like up and puking and the whole nine yards, okay? So everybody else in the hotel room's trying to sleep. I can't sleep. I turn on the TV at like 3 o'clock, and sure enough, it's Rumors, Bargains, and Lies on the television. And part of me was pleased to find Babylon 5 on at 3 a.m. while I was just ill, out of my mind. But the other part of it was that I really wish it had been a different episode because it just wasn't strong enough to make me forget how awful I was feeling.
I want a better episode so I don't have to think about how shitty I feel.
That really was basically it, yeah. Yeah, I wanted something with a lot of space battles or something, I don't know.
We're going to have to start a survey on that. What episodes would you consider? What are your top 10 episodes to watch when you're sick to make you forget that you're sick? That you're feeling poorly?
There we go.
We need to start a book. Chicken Soup for the Babylon 5 fan.
Yeah, so there you go, listeners. Send in your emails. Tell us what you'd rather see when you're puking your guts out.
If you're laid up, feverish, you know, recovering from a broken arm from ice skating or something, what Babylon 5 episodes would soothe you, make you feel better? Let us know.
Yeah, please.
Leave us some comments on the. I'm sure somebody in the chat room will start a thread on it in the forums over at farpointforums.com. Yeah, call in. Call in the voicemail number. Send us an email. Post it at the forums. We'll find out. But I think we've covered everything for this.
Yeah, I think so too.
Okay. In that case, we are done with the debriefing, and we'll be back in a minute to close this out.
Yay.
The following message has been approved by the Inner Council of the SSDWC, the secret society for delayed world conquest. We here at the SSDWC would like to remind you that playing with either robot weaponry or skyscraper infrastructure is all well and good until somebody loses an I-beam. I'm Kim, the comic book goddess, and I'd like to invite you to a new temple. Here at the Geek Pantheon, we minister to the spiritual needs of our subculture and apply our way of life to the mainstream. We can show you how the deities of geekdom are numerous as grains of sand. There's a little geek in everyone, if you look closely. will bring you the gods and goddesses of geekdom to bestow knowledge you won't find anywhere else, as well as commentary from the SSDWC, the Secret Society for Delayed World Conquest, and, of course, your moment of Kim. So join us for talk about everything from alignment to zombies, and all those things that you thought wouldn't fit in between. Geek Pantheon and your moment of Kim. Broaden your geek horizons. Don't enter your battle of wits unarmed. Find us at geekpantheon.com.
And we're back to close this puppy out.
Yep. We got a couple voicemails and an email that didn't quite get through the, didn't get caught in the feedback of Palooza from last week. So we want to get these taken care of.
Okay.
Hi, guys. It's Edmund from Greenville and Three-Edged Sword on VoicesOfBabylon.com. As a lifelong fan and now occasional dabbler in the B5 universe, it was great to see Bruce Boxleitner join Heroes, but his character got me wondering. He's a gray-haired, powerful politician who's a player with the chops to bed Ali Larter's latest trauma-induced multiple personality split. Now, who could they have been basing that on? I'm wondering when we're going to be introduced to his equally ambitious wife, who just happens to be partial to wearing monochromatic pantsuits. Be seeing you.
Yes, the cult of personality has gone so deep. We even have Oliver Stone making a movie about George. Nobody's immune from archetypes or stereotypes. Stereotypes anymore.
Stereotypes, yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, I've got an email here I want to read.
Okay.
This comes to us from Gaio in Toronto. Hello, Tim, Summer, Michael, and Jeffrey. A lot of people may hate me for saying this, but I think this period of time between projects can only be a good thing for Babylon 5. I grew up with Star Wars. That was a big fan of Doctor Who. Those science fiction universes, along with Star Trek, had a period of time between projects. We know now that we won't be getting anything to come out of the B5 universe for the time being. If you believe, like me, that life is cyclical in some way, then one can say Hollywood's recycling of TV shows from years past would be such an example. Maybe we'll get a feature film set in the Babylon 5 universe because Warner thinks it's a good idea. My money is down that when JMS is done with all the projects he's always wanted to do, he'll have a soft spot for his baby and come back to the sandbox that we all know and love and start playing in it again. Second life that these universes enjoyed, Star Trek, Star Wars, and Doctor Who, did not come out from the vacuum that was the lull I mentioned earlier in the email. Fans have kept the embers alive, be it the naming of the Space Shuttle Enterprise or fans setting up a small company and acquiring the license to create Doctor Who audio dramas. These people have been rewarded for their passion, not only by getting their universes back into the fold, but in some cases creating something official for that particular universe. Why can we not do that with Babylon 5? I applauded the efforts of Yarstow, Edmund, and John when they first released Three-Edged Sword. It was because I saw the parallels of those Doctor Who fans on the internet who kept that universe alive. Not only that, I've learned through the Babylon podcast of two video game projects. I'm looking forward to the day that Summer releases whatever project she's got in her head. So it seems there's some momentum our way when it comes to fan projects. But I only hope that Warner would take the example of BBC, Paramount, and Lucasfilm and allow these projects to continue. A lot of these projects are done for the love of those respective universes. By doing these projects, fans can hope that one day they'll see the universe back in the spotlight again. And isn't hope what Babylon 5 is all about? Thanks and keep up the good work. You guys definitely kept the candle burning for me when I thought there would be no more Babylon 5, especially when I'm working in the basement of a hospital on a night shift. So,
we can shine some light into his life. I will admit, it wasn't until recently that someone pointed out that the people in charge of Warner may not actually be Hollywood people. They may be AOL leftovers from when AOL bought.
Okay, so you're saying that because they were not necessarily Hollywood types, that they don't have an understanding of that industry?
I would say, not a real understanding, not a real passion for it, and no real desire to learn. That's my crazy theory.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you know what that does? There, as you said that, I was thinking and came in up against, a stereotype, we're back to that.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption that the people who are cutting edge with things like the internet, the World Wide Web, as AOL once was, that those kind of people have a certain passion for things like movies and television and other pop culture media. And one would think that they would be very interested in seeing something like a Babylon 5 continue on, but maybe not. Maybe if there's just, you know, venture capitalists looking to, you know, where they can maximize their dollar, you know, maybe that explains some of it.
It's been a very, 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 very long time since anything AOL was handled was considered cutting edge.
Uh-huh.
And once AOL started making real money, my bet is those people were bought out by suits, the stereotypical suits.
Okay, sure, that makes sense.
And I don't know.
No, your theory has merit, Summer.
But it's not, if it was only Warner that was doing it, I'd understand. You know, we'd see more crash and burns from Warner. But they actually have gotten a few things right lately, movie-wise. But all of Hollywood is, the remake thing they're talking about, driving me crazy. It's not, and they're not remaking the good stuff. They're remaking the crap.
Oh, come on,
awesome.
Now. Banana split.
No.
You're not stoked for that one?
Who in their right mind thinks that remaking Rocky Horror Picture Show is a good idea? Okay.
I am right there with you, sister.
Oh, no. I got one worse for you. Saw it today in the Hollywood Reporter. Somebody has pitched and been given a green light to do a remake of The Partridge Family. WTF. WTF, man. Why? Why? Someone explain that to me.
It's, you know what it is? You know what I really think it is with a lot of these things? I think it is someone who is between the ages of 45 and 55 who remembers fondly of their childhood and what their favorite television show is.
No, it's not even, you can't blame nostalgia for all this. These are a whole lot of people who are so afraid of keeping their jobs that all they can think of is remaking stuff that people know. Like, oh, yeah, that has a known name. We'll have an audience for that. It'll work. No. At some point in time, it has to stop. At some point in time, you have to say, enough is enough with the remakes. We're going, because people's viewing tastes are becoming more sophisticated.
Well, are they, though? I mean, if they keep giving us Dukes of Hazzard and Partridge Family and Brady Bunch, are they?
Okay. They thought remaking Knight Rider was going to be the brilliant save-all move. That's not working out all that well.
No, that's true.
Okay. It went enough people. I mean, literally. The movie was fine. Oh, sure, do another Knight Rider movie. No big deal. Everybody will turn into it. Don't assume that it's going to be a good idea for a TV series that the same number of people will watch. Case in point, the Caveman TV series based off the characters in the Geico commercials. Works great for a 30-second commercial. What were you thinking trying to draw that out to 30 minutes? The
Fair
money
enough.
They wasted making that series, they could have given to Joss Whedon, and we could have gotten a full 2-hour Dr. Horrible movie.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
No, I'm with you.
There's.
I know, I mean, that's the one thing, that it's the oddity of that business, and we've talked about it before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it some more, that despite the fact that it's a creative process, they're still making product. You know?
But when the process is so subverted by just lack of creativity, how can it be a creative process? I understand it's a business process, but if nobody buys your product, if nobody returns your value on your product, you're going to have to reevaluate how you choose and produce that product sometime, aren't you?
Sure, but that's the point, though. It's still product at that point. I mean, every company that's out there manufacturing something, offering something up to the public sector, they'll have hits and they'll have misses. Okay? And, I mean, you know, and so what do? They go back and they look at it and they'll either say, okay, we need to come up with something that is so outlandishly different that it's just going to blow everybody away, or we need to make what everybody else is making because that's what's making money. And that's, I mean, and that goes for cars, ketchup, and television shows. I mean, you know, because the flip side of it in terms of creativity or lack thereof is things like Survivor. That show has been going on for a long time. And really, how creative is it? Take a bunch of people and dump them in a purportedly wild environment, but it can't be that wild, you know, and just let the cameras roll. I mean, what is that?
Literally, if you forced a gun to my head and told me to choose between something inane, some inane reality show that I care nothing about, like Project Runway, or a rerun of The Partridge Family, I'll choose the outrageous models and fashion designers who have, like, we're talking half a millimeter of depth to them. Okay?
Okay. But why would you choose that?
I think it takes more effort to put together a reality show than it does for somebody to say, okay, I'm going to remake something from 40 years ago because I don't know any better, because I don't care any better, because I'm too fucking lazy.
I would disagree. I think it's the same level of effort. It's just that it manifests itself in two different ways.
Nope. If somebody came up with Survivor, they had to actually put some effort into it, because at the time it was a new idea. Sure, giving it to us year in and year out, no problem. You're continuing on with that original idea. Somebody had to come up with that idea, put that idea together, and pitch it in such a way that someone would say, okay, yeah, that'll work. How much work does it take to watch The Partridge Family and go, hey, let's remake this?
I can't argue with you so much there. Yeah.
I reality shows may be inane, but they are taking advantage of people who want their 15 minutes of fame on TV. I don't watch all of them. You know, I will admit I have my weakness. My weakness is Top Chef. That's it. Remaking Partridge Family offends me. Remaking Rocky Horror Picture Show offends me. I dare someone to remake Heavy Metal. Actually, they did. They tried to make a sequel of that, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
That was bad.
That's a difference than a remake. No, they need to do a live-action version of Heavy Metal.
There you go.
And I've seen that recently. It doesn't hold up well over time. Anyway, we have gone far afield. And we've got one last voicemail. Well, okay. Anyways, thanks for that to Gaio for his email, because there's a certain optimism there.
Oh, yeah.
This is Neil calling from the future. The Babylon 5 Crusade movie was just absolutely amazing, and it was great that they stopped by Babylon 5. So we saw Tim and Summer and drinking with Jeffrey and his uncle there. That was just amazing. The Telepath War movie was just spectacular. And then, of course, the two Babylon 4 movies were just spectacular. looking back upon the times when we were complaining about JMS just going for future movies, it just seems a little silly now. But now that we've had all these movies and a new series is in the works, it's just amazing. This is it, Neil calling from the future.
I like his vision of the future.
I do too.
I never thought of that. A movie about Babylon 4.
Yeah, about that. Two of them even.
Mm-hmm. There would have to be two. There'd have to be a movie about what happened when Babylon 4 first arrived.
Uh-huh.
Back in Valen's time, you know, with Valen on board. And then a movie about winning the war and the disappearance of Babylon 4 again. You know, what we don't know what happened to Babylon 4 at the end of that Shadow War. Or, you know, what happened, how long was Valen on Minbar before he disappeared?
I don't know. I don't know any of that timeline.
I'm have to go look that up.
I got the impression that Valen lived to a fairly ripe old age.
He did, but he and his children had to leave Minbar. And it was, they came back later. Much later.
Yeah, I don't know.
I still think we're going to find Babylon 4 hiding in a pocket. Folded pocket of hyperspace someday. Oh yeah, Babylon 4 movies would be cool. First Shadow War movie would be cool. Telepath War movie would be really cool. A movie about what led up to the Great Burn. You know, that war that we saw in
Deconstruction.
Deconstruction, yeah. The Garibaldi. No, I've been looking around here. I love that whole scene.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, that was fairly apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things that struck me, and I know we'll get to geeking on that, but that concept of even that far in the future, with the Interstellar Alliance still having some strength,
mm-hmm.
apparently, that Earth itself was in a position that it was still so fractious that various sides would have the kind of armament required to wipe out most of the Earth. That was just really kind of depressing.
I thought it was interesting, though, that you know, the ideals and the idea that the Alliance held were so strong that they felt they needed to literally rewrite history in order to swing public opinion away from it. I mean, that's the part that fascinated me. How did Earth Alliance fall so far?
Don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of spots in the chronologies of Babylon 5, ding, that we could make movies or miniseries out of. There's, I wouldn't say endless topics of interest, but there are a good other five or six spots that would make really, really compelling stories. Should the resources and the desire come together at the same time and choose to bring them forth, breathe life into it and us again?
Well, they do in Neil's timeline, so let's hope that we're also living in that timeline.
Okay. Well, so. He said he was sipping drinks with the three of us, so...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Eddie Premier of a Babylon 5, no less. So yeah, I'm all down for Neil's alternate future there.
Yeah, absolutely. Great email, Neil. Thanks for that.
Got any more?
Nope, that's it.
Okay then. In that case, you know where to find us: BabylonPodcast.com. Go visit us on the forums. There's a Babylon Podcast forum at farpointforums.com. Please come to the website. Donate to us so we can keep Mike's equipment in tip-top shape. And they won't sound like this so much, maybe. If you want to send in your own comments, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can call in a voicemail like Neil and the others did. That number is 206-338 2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Telepath War movie won the Oscar.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the end.